Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 165 of Season 8 of Movie Rob Minute, the Daily Podcast, where we FUBAR our way through the 1998 Steven Spielberg award-winning film Saving Private Ryan, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me on this very special episode is someone that you might have heard of, you might not have heard of. It's, let's say, Saving Private Ryan adjacent. You know, there's this little miniseries that was amazing called Band of Brothers. And one of the characters in Band of Brothers is named George Luz. And I was able to get an interview, and we're going to have a conversation today with the son of George Luz. So this is George Luz Jr. So, George, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks so much, Rob. It's great to be on.
Yeah, it's great to finally be able to hear you. But right. So again, this is something that's adjacent to Saving Private Ryan. But we'll start with the little basics here. I mean, I know that you have spent the last nearly 30 years talking about Band of Brothers, talking about everything that your father did. You know, Band of Brothers, for anyone who is unfamiliar, even though my assumption is you are familiar, it's you know, it was a book written by Stephen Ambrose that was made into an HBO miniseries by Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg. Obviously, it sort of is a continuation, or you might want to call it a companion piece to this movie. And one of the characters, one of the funniest characters in this whole miniseries was George Luz, who we now know is George Luz Sr., but at the time he was just George Luz. You know, he's the one who was doing all the imitations of Colonel Sink and, you know, causing a lot of problems throughout. Very fun character. But, you know, the first of all, there is a connection, and George and I have discussed this. There is a pseudo connection between Band of Brothers and Saving Private Ryan. So why don't you start off there? Do you want to explain to everyone the connection?
Yeah, well, thanks, Rob, for that intro. The, you know, the guy who played, there were two guys in the unit. You had Skip Muck. And you had Fritz Neiland, and they were buddies in Tonawanda. And so there's a story about how they were buddies and how they met in London. And if you read the book Band of Brothers, there is a little snippet in there. And if you go back to when Tom and Steve bought the rights to two books, Band of Brothers and Citizen Soldier, mm-hmm. They bought the rights to both of those books, Steve Ambrose. And within those two books, there's that little snippet of a story in there. And so that's where the genesis was for coming up with Saving Private Ryan. Now, the guy's name was Fritz Neiland, and they couldn't call it Saving Fritz Neiland. So they announced it, they changed it to Saving Private Ryan. And I remember going to the movie with my dad, and it came out in 98. And it was about 3 months before my dad passed away that him and I did go to that movie. So it was really pretty cool. And as a lead up to that, Winters. Now, Winters used to stay really in touch with most of the guys in the company. And he sent out this letter to my dad, along with all the rest of the guys. And if you like, I can read it to you.
Oh, I'd love to hear that. And that would be great.
Yeah, it says a Don Mularkey story, a Band of Brothers about going to London prior to the invasion with Skip Muck and Joe Torre and Grant. Meeting with the Neiland brothers of Tonawanda is the story behind Saving Private Ryan. You as a veteran, by all means, should go to see this movie. You will relate it very strongly to your experience from the beginning to the end. Hang tough, Dick.
Wow.
And that was the letter that he sent my dad.
And, I mean, do you remember if your father enjoyed the movie? What did he think of it? Did it bring back, you know, memories that weren't necessarily so pleasant? Or, I mean, did he discuss these things with you or not really?
Well, okay, so we go to the movie and you know, it was a very powerful movie. Very powerful.
For sure.
So as we stand up after the movie was over, as we stand up and there's a hush as they're rolling the credits, my dad looks over at me and says, "What the hell was that? We weren't in any of those places. They were marching too close together." So he kind of went through this litany of cinematography faux pas. But I think what it was, he was a little bit annoyed at the fact that the infantry guys were complaining that, why do we have to go and find this airborne guy? And this airborne guy just happened to be, you know, one of the buddies of his buddy.
Right.
So so he was a little torqued off at that. Or it was just a way of him to diffuse maybe what he had saw, because how powerful that movie was.
Right. Okay, that's very. I mean, growing up, did your father talk about his experiences during the war, or did he basically close everything off until I guess Ambrose came out with the book, or because of all the reunions and stuff like that, your family was aware? Like, because I remember from the miniseries, you know, at the end when they give the epilogue, they mention the fact that that at your father's funeral, it surprised everyone that there were so many people who showed up, because most people didn't know that he was so connected to so many people. I don't know if it's specifically because of his connection to Easy Company or not.
Well, you know, we lived in a small town too. But no, my dad, you know, I went to my very first reunion in 1965. Dad went to the reunions as soon as they began, and they began in 1946, wow. Right after the war. The 100 of us got together. The first reunion was in Indianapolis, Indiana, and that was the very first reunion. Now, every year, barring some issue, my mom and dad went to the reunions.
Wow.
And so I was blessed to be able to go as a kid. So, like I said, you know, I was able to, my first reunion was in Fort Campbell, Kentucky in 1965. I went again in 1968 and 1970 and 1981, et cetera, et cetera. And I was always blessed to be connected with him and his buddies and their wives. Unfortunately, when I was a kid, though, there weren't a lot of kids that went. So my sister and I were one of the few kids that were there. There was a couple, but not like it. But hey, remember, you know, when I'm on a vacation with my mother and the father, you know, we're happy the place has a pool. So anyway, and you don't really get the significance of these men and their wives until you grow up a little bit and you understand and you read the book and you know, because my dad used to tell me stories and stuff like that. So it wasn't like, and he wasn't hiding it from anybody. If a local newspaper guy said, "Hey, I'd like to do a story about you," he certainly would share stories. So he never had a problem in talking about the war. I remember kind of a humorous story about, one of my high school history teachers, Clint Waddell. I remember him meeting him many years after my dad had passed away. And he was telling me a story about when he had just got out of college and he got a job at a defense contractor where my dad worked. And so he comes up to me years after my dad passes away and he says, "You know, I used to work with your dad." And he used to tell me all these crazy stories about World War II. And I never knew they were true until the series came out.
So
he didn't suffer from post-traumatic stress, battle fatigue, whatever it was, in any sort of a way that I or anybody else would have observed. My mother, on the other hand, you know, she never really talked that dad did have any of those symptoms from that. And he might have just been one of the lucky ones.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What type of connection did your father have with the other guys in Easy Company over the years? Was it just the reunions, or was other things also?
The really cool thing was, you know, they got together every year. They did stay together. there was a lot of correspondence back and forth. There was a lot of letters and it was Christmas cards, letters, phone calls. And so they were connected throughout the course of the year. And that was, you know, one of the really cool things was, and I go back and look at letters that my dad got from this guy, letters that he got from that guy. And, you know, when I travel on tour and I do a lot of speaking events, and when I'm traveling, I share a lot of the audio and some video of my dad. And I shared some of the letters, some of the correspondence back and forth that these guys had. And that I'm really blessed to not only have that stuff, but to share that with other people.
Yeah, wow, that's amazing. And was there anyone that your father was particularly close with from the rest of the guys in the Easy Company? Or was it just that they all had this connection? So it wasn't that there was one that was more or less. It was that, okay, these are all my brothers type of thing.
Essentially, yeah. But I look at some of the photographs. And if I were to guess in this whole thread of guys who he loved, maybe, just maybe, the one could possibly be Frank Percani.
Okay.
And because he was very close with Frank during the war. And if you look at some of the reunion pictures, the ones that I've got, there's a lot of pictures. If my dad's in the picture, there's a lot with my dad and Frank. And so my dad and Frank, and there was other guys too, Walter Gordon. You know, mm-hmm. Walter was the big guy from, he was actually born in Jackson, Mississippi, but he moved to Louisiana. And then there was another guy named Gordy Carson. And so if you look at the pictures, you know, if I were to guess, but he loved all the guys too, you know, and then I was able to develop great friendships with these guys, especially Frank too. And it was always a treat to call these guys. I had this kind of a rotation over a 2-week period where I would touch base with them. And my wife was the cutest thing. She would say, "So who are you calling tonight?" And I would just kind of go through the rolling rotation of whether it was, you know, Frank or Bill Garnier or Babe Heffron or Buck Compton, you know, et cetera, Shifty Powers. And so it was really neat when my dad passed away. He was actually killed in an industrial accident. But when that happened, these guys really filled a void of me losing my father.
Right. Understandable. Were most of them able to make it for the funeral?
Well, no, actually they didn't, but Bill Garnier did. Mm-hmm. You know, because he wasn't that far away.
It was about, right.
You know, but naturally we got a lot of phone calls and things from all my dad's buddies and, you know, my mom. Because, you know, my mom, the wives played a huge role in the series. I mean, in the lives of these guys, because the wives all went to, not all of them, most of them all went to the reunions. So the wives had a special connection themselves.
Right.
But Bill Garnier came to my dad's services. And I credit Bill with the number that HBO used in the miniseries. Because we're Catholic, so, you know, they have these wakes. Well, at that point, Bill went outside and he sat on the stoop and he met every person that came in and he talked to everybody and he sat there the entire time smoking cigarettes and just talking with everybody. And so I credit Bill with that number of 1600 because Bill was a numbers guy anyway. But I remember my buddy from work said, "Gee whiz, you know, I got there and the line was out the door around the corner and down the street." So he said it was like the mayor died or something like that.
Wow.
Now this was before the series came out.
Right.
But it was in 98, right?
You said it was a few months after the movie, the Saving Private Ryan came out. Right.
That's correct. Yeah. So, you know, it was a testament to my dad, not only my dad, but my mom in the community. You know, we lived in a little town And that's the way it was. That's the way it was. But my dad, he had a way of touching people in a way that they always felt as though if he was with them, he was with them. And it wasn't, you know, like sometimes somebody in like the they're like looking over your shoulder saying, let's see, is there anybody here I should be talking to other than this guy?
Right.
He wasn't he wasn't like that, man. He was the life of the party, a fun guy, and people just love being around.
Right. Do you think your father would have liked the miniseries?
Yeah, yeah. He would be very proud that, you know, Tom and Steven, you know, took on this project, told their story. Two things. My guess would be he would be very happy, and he would hope that all of the people who watch the series say to themselves, I wonder what my dad did, and I wonder, oh, my grandfather, what did he do? Or my grandmother,
right.
What did they do? And then that inquisitive nature to find out, because, you know, my dad was just, he was one of 16 million Americans and that served in World War II, and everybody had a job and everybody did it. And they all got fascinating stories. And I would hope, and I'm sure he would have hoped that everybody would have had a chance to tell their story.
Right.
The other part of it, which he really would have loved, was the extra time with the men. Because, you know, they got together every year. And now, like I said, there was correspondence throughout the year. But when the series came out, they were being asked to go, you know, let's see, do you want to come to sit in the luxury box at the Super Bowl or Indy 500 or Daytona 500 or baseball, basketball game? Or, you know what, we're going to put this group together with 20 veterans, 20 of your buddies, and we're going to send them to Europe, and you guys are going to retrace your footsteps. So he would have really loved the extra time with his buddies.
Wow. And based on your conversations with other guys from Easy, were most of them pleased with what happened, what was portrayed in the miniseries, or were some of them caught up on some of the small little thing in the small little inaccuracies, or the fact that there were characters that were you know, melded together, or some that were completely ignored? Because obviously, even in a miniseries that size, you can't portray everyone.
That's a very good point, Rob. On a positive note, yeah, I think the guys were really, really happy that their story was told. And not to overshadow anyone else's, because, you know, to a man, these guys knew they didn't win the war. Everybody fought. And I know there was a certain amount of folks who felt as though they were getting too much press. And there's a little bit of Easy Company fatigue, let's say, to a certain degree. But the men, never were, you know, just there, you know, on top of the soapbox saying, we did it, we did it, we did it. It wasn't that at all. That was a humble generation, and they weren't like that. They were very welcoming, and they were also very welcoming to veterans who were in the area. When they would have their reunions, if there were veterans in that area that they knew, they would welcome them to their reunion. So it wasn't, there was no exclusivity to this. They were a very welcoming bunch of men. You're right. There were challenges, however, because, you know, you couldn't portray every veteran, because, right, you know, there was 140 guys came out of Toccoa, and then I think in one of Marcus Brotherton's book, I think he said that there was about 360 plus that went through the entire unit during World War II, during the entire 1942 to 19. So yeah, and you couldn't portray anybody, and that was one of the tough things for me was, yeah, I knew all these guys, all of the men who fought in the war and survived, who came to reunions, I knew all those guys.
Right.
I was very blessed to have been welcome. I wasn't Luz, but I was Luz's kid. And
right.
I was welcome into their world. But yeah, so I felt bad in a sense where some guys who were shoulder to shoulder with my dad, but they didn't get the recognition that my dad got.
Right.
So,
And at the reunions over the years, did many of the, I mean, you said at the beginning, you and your sister were pretty much the only kids that were there. But did it reach a point where they started bringing their families, you know, their kids also? Like, is there like a second generation of, you know, Easy Company connections?
Oh, yeah, for sure. You know, I do remember 1981. 1981, I did go to that reunion. I was an adult. And then there were several other kids there. Tracy and her sister Cindy Compton, Buck Compton's daughters, mm-hmm. were there. Walter Gordon, two of his daughters, Bebe and Linda Gordon, were there. Don Malarkey's daughter, Marianne, was there. And so it started picking up. And another thing, too, it was kind of, let's say, regional in a sense. So let's say that, you know, they had a reunion in Portland, Oregon. Well, you know,
Malarkey's from Oregon, right? Okay.
Yeah, so let's say in that particular case there, Malarkey was there, so all of his kids would come. So in
right.
some cases, let's face it, all these guys were in different kind of groups. So in some cases, all the kids would come. And, you know, recently we had a reunion here in Newport, Rhode Island, because we still get together every year, last year. And then so all of our family, the Luz family, my sister was able to get all of her kids. They enjoyed the heck out of it because some of her children have come to reunions prior.
Mm-hmm.
So the tempo did pick up. And like I said, we still do get together. This year we were together in San Diego in September.
Wow.
So we had our East family reunion in September in San Diego.
Wow. That's really, really cool. I mean, it's unfortunate that none of the men from Easy are still around. I mean, I think you mentioned to me at some point that there was like a big birthday party for Buck Compton on his 90th birthday or something like that. What's the story behind that?
Well, that was really cool. You know, Tracy, Buck's daughter, had reached out to me and said, hey, we're going to have a party for my dad. It's his 90th birthday. Can you come out? And then my wife, who always, my wife, Susan, she always figures out ways to make sure I get to these important things. So anyway, I said, all right, Tracy, just don't tell your dad that I'm coming. And so I wanted to be a surprise. So I flew out there and it was really great. And Tracy and her sister Cindy did an amazing job putting it together. And it was at a regional little airport type thing, not a commercial, but a, you know, regional. A lot of guys with private jets and guys and gals with private jets.
Mm-hmm.
So this one guy who was there said to Tracy as they were planning this, is there anything I can do? And Tracy said, is it possible if you fly to Los Angeles and pick up Neil, who played her dad, and his wife, Ruev, and a couple of the actors, you know, Michael Cudlitz, James Matteo, Richard Spade, and come to the reunion, which is going to be on that day. And he said, yeah, sure. I guess when you get a jet, all it is jet fuel, right?
Wow.
You're the pilot, your own plane. So it was super, super cool. So we're all there and stuff like that. And we're all there, and it says, okay, hey, the plane is 5 minutes out. Plane is just getting ready to touch down. So the plane comes in. We're all standing near all these windows looking out on the runway, and the plane lands and kind of taxis on over, and all the actors get out. And it was really great. They just embraced the heck out of the crowd and Buck, and it was so terrific to celebrate Buck's 90th birthday that
wow.
way. It was just great.
Wow, that's amazing.
And another wonderful moment. And then another story, too, is Buck's book came out. Marcus Brotherton wrote a great book about Buck Compton's life. And it was more about his life than just the war. It's a fascinating book about it. And, you know, if you like to read, I'm not selling any books, but it's a wonderful book to read. And once again, you know,
Buck was a prosecutor, right?
He was. He was a prosecuting attorney in the Sirhan-Sirhan case.
Right.
And so Marcus had said, I had talked to Marcus and I said, hey, when is Buck's book coming out? Can you give me a heads up? Susan and I would love to come out for that. So he gave us the heads up. We flew to Seattle, and I said, hey, do me a favor, you know, make it a surprise that we're coming. So it's at a Barnes & Noble or something like that. It begins at 7. So my wife and I were a little bit 10 minutes late or something like that. And as we coming up the escalator, we're just figuring here's the second floor of the Barnes & Noble. We're just figuring that, you know, we're just going to slide into the back and just listen to him tell his story at this opening. So as we come up, I look over to the right, and there's Marcus, Buck, and his daughter. And Marcus, like, gives the old looking at his watch routine, like, you're late. So it's like, so we walk on over, and, you know, hey, how you doing? And, you know, give Tracy and Buck a hug, and hi, Marcus, how is it going? And then he says, okay, George, this is how we're going to do this. I'm going to get on the podium, and I'm going to say a few words. I am going to introduce you, and then you are going to introduce Buck. It was like, wow, I'm going to introduce Buck. Holy moly, I'm not prepared to do this. I just came to show up and listen in the back. So so anyway, that was just, you know, for me to be able to introduce Buck at his book opening was, yeah, it may sound like not a big deal, but, you know, it was really cool to be
there. I disagree with you. It does sound like a big deal. So, you know, makes sense. So we talked a little about, you know, the various men of Easy and what they thought of the, you know, the miniseries and stuff like that. But what did you and your family think of the actor who played your father in the miniseries? So your father's character was played by Rick Gomez. I mean, did you guys think that he did an accurate portrayal, or, you know, did he meet with, actually couldn't meet with your father beforehand, but did he meet with the family to learn more about the character in order to create the character, or he just went with whatever he was told and what he read in, you know, read in the book or whatever?
Well, he did get a chance to talk to my mom, which was great. And we had a brief conversation, but he did an amazing job. You know, there's the book Band of Brothers is in there. You've also got another great book by Webster called Parachute Infantry. And if you ever read that book, about halfway through, there is a lot of my father in there. And it's a good example of how, you know, if you think my father was crazy to begin with, if you read Parachute Infantry, he was even crazier than I thought he was.
Oh, wow.
So he did have sources. And then one of the other good things he did have, too, was James Matteo, who played Frank Bracani. Mm-hmm. These guys were tight. The actors were very tight, and I'm very proud of the actors. They did such a great job, you know, portraying these men. They're great ambassadors for not only the men they portrayed, but veterans in general. You know, they're very hospitable. They're very humble by it all. But yeah, so Rick did a great job, and I think probably if any there was any issues, he could have talked with James, who was in constant communication with Frank. And then he could just say, because my dad and Frank were, you know, in the same platoon, he could just say, hey, can you ask Frank what was George's situation here? And I'm sure they probably had conversations like that.
Oh, wow.
And but yeah, we're very proud of Rick and what he did. And I was fortunate enough to see Rick, I think, 2 years ago. In let's see, where was that? New Orleans, the museum in New Orleans, at a World War II museum, had a 20th anniversary of Band of Brothers, and they did a wonderful job. They brought in the actors, the writers, the directors, the producers, Dale Dye, his entire team. And it was really great. And they brought along five of us kids to take part in a panel discussion with the actor who played our family member.
Oh, wow.
So that, yeah. And you can go on YouTube and look that up. World War II Museum Symposium Band of Brothers, and it was wonderful. They did such a great job.
Wow,
and you know,
that's
telling
amazing.
the story. Yeah, we had a great time. Had a great time.
Yeah. Now, growing up, hearing all these stories from your father and from all of Easy Company, did it make you want to be a part of the military? Did you want to have your own connection to, a family the way that your father had?
Well, you know, when you grow up in that environment, that's the environment that it's the only environment you know, and you think everybody else's environment is the same way. So in my world, in my little world, everybody, and in the reality it was, everybody's father was in the war.
Right.
In some cases, somebody's mothers were in the war. So it wasn't anything unique. Although it was in a sense, because you know we went to reunions as kids, but you got to remember I was the baby of the family, so my brother was the oldest, Steve, and so my parents learned how to be parents with him, and then my sister was the middle one, and so they improved on what they learned from the first one, and then when you're the baby of the family, you get special treatment. So my life was much softer than my. And then to a lesser degree, my sister. So yeah, so I had no hardships at all. I wasn't I was let's just say I was born with a plastic spoon, not a silver spoon in my mind.
Okay.
But
Okay.
it was a spoon anyway, a plastic spoon.
Right.
But no, so when I graduated high school, the Vietnam War was ending. And so I was very fortunate enough that I didn't have to go to war. And my brother was in Vietnam. He was there in 68, 69 in Vietnam. And okay, so when he was there, I was 12. Now, when at my age, there was one TV. So you sat there with mom and dad, you watched TV at nighttime, and you saw the news and you saw the newsreels. And even at 12, I could see that my brother being away in harm's way for a year really grinded on my mom. My dad, on the other hand, you know, he had a different, not mindset, but he had a different facade. And so, yeah, I was very fortunate enough. I didn't have to, excuse me, join the military. I did work for a defense contractor. And then, yeah, I couldn't have handled the, res not the responsibility, but, you know, you got to be paying attention. And, you know, you, in the military, well, I really would have liked learning some of the things that people in the military did learn, all that discipline stuff. Because, you know, I not that I was undisciplined, but, you know, when you're in the military, you learn stuff. And then the big thing is what men and women have who serve in the military, what they have today,
Right.
they have that connection.
Right.
And I don't have that connection. I see that connection, and I admire that connection.
Okay, that's fair. Did your father ever travel back to Europe over the years? I'm assuming that there are members of Easy Company that were buried in France that weren't. I don't think all of them were brought back to be buried in the States. So did he ever go to with some of his buddies, to go visit the places that they had been or anything like that?
No, that was one of the things, you know, I never really asked him that question. And for some reason, I'm not sure. It could be one of two things. The reunions were the key thing because those were the concentrated moments he had with the men when they would go on these reunions. And the other thing was a handful of the guys would go, a handful of the guys naturally went over. Winters, Lipton, I know Garnier and Heffron went over several times, Walter Gordon, and there were many others, I'm sure, but my dad never had an affinity to go back. I'm not exactly sure why, and I think it's either one of two things, whether maybe he didn't want to go back, or he just wanted to make sure the resources that they had got together at the reunions where you had 30, 40, 50 guys there.
Right. Okay. That's fair. So I know that you are continuing the chain of connections from Easy Company and Band of Brothers and explaining things, and you do tours and stuff like that. So how did you get into that eventually? Like, how did that work?
Well, what kind of happened was, all right, so I grew up around the guys and stuff, and then I had met this guy, John McGowan, great guy. He had come to one of our events. I'm on the board of a foundation, a World War II foundation, and we do documentaries. It's a WWII foundation. I think we're up to 40 documentaries. Wow. And a monument to winners. So we were at an event, and this guy had come up to me with the book called Rendezvous with Destiny. It was like one of the very first books that came out. And he came up to me with this book. He opened it up and he said, I want to show you something. And he opened up the book at one of these events. And there was my dad's signature on this book.
Oh, wow.
And it's, holy Toledo, where did you get that? So he said, I bought it at a used bookstore. Holy smokes. A used bookstore with my dad's signature in it. Now, this was, my dad signed that book decades ago. So anyway, so he had asked me, he said, hey, could you come? And he was in East Boston. And he said, can you come to my Kiwanis meeting and do a Band of Brothers type speech? So at that point, I said, you know what? There's enough veterans out there who could tell their story. And I would prefer to hear it from them. And I think everybody else would also. So I was able to kind of rebuff him on that. And then our next event we had in Providence, he came again. John came again, and he was, once again, he said, geez, you know, could you possibly come? And I relented. I says, okay, all right, I'll do it. So that was my very first speech in 2015 with the help of my buddy, Tim and Anthony. Tim was my editor, so to speak, and he was able to help me with that. And I put together a PowerPoint presentation, which has evolved to now what I think it's quite good. And not that it wasn't good in the beginning, but so it's
no, but over time it makes sense that over time things it gets better. You have new things to add.
Yeah. So I'm blessed. So I've been doing it since 2015. It's kind of accelerated. And I've been real busy. Actually, I just got back this weekend. I was in North and South Carolina. I had a speech there, which was really, really great. It was a bunch of veterans there. It was a veterans weekend lunch, veterans breakfast weekend type thing. It was really cool. I got a chance to go to the air show in Monroe and just meet all kinds of really neat folks. And then the week before that, I was in Lancaster, PA. Lancaster. They say Lancaster, not Lancaster. Lancaster.
Right.
I always get that wrong. So I was there, and I was speaking at an event, which is HMGS, which is Historical Miniatures Gaming Society. They have this event called Fall In 2024. It was in Lancaster. And so that was great. So, you know, I've been really busy. I travel with Steve Ambrose several times a year, four or five times a year with them on tours with my dear friend Chris Anderson, who knew the Men of Easy Company very, very well. And then actually I just started doing cruise ships too. I was on a Crystal Cruise as a guest lecturer, which was just, it's really cool for me to do this stuff and share these stories.
Yeah, no, I'm fascinated by everything that you're telling us. You know, I mean, you mentioned to me that at some point both Earl and Shifty, wanted to like pass the torch on to you or something like that. So what's the story behind that? You said that they gave you a responsibility or something like that.
Yeah, it was really funny. Earl and Shifty, those guys are very close. They were very close. But so the one reunion, I get there and Earl comes up to me and he said, okay, George. From here on in, it's going to be your responsibility to hand Shifty his drink as soon as he comes through the door at the hotel. So anyway, and I knew Shifty drank screwdrivers. So, just orange juice and vodka. So anyway, so that was my responsibility. So that particular year, so then I'm just processing in my head. Okay, so either he's coming with, let's see, his son Wayne or his daughter Margot and her husband. see. So let's see. They're going to be flying in, driving in. Okay. So I kind of figured out generally what time they'd be getting there. So then, you know, there's always people mingling around. So I would just hang out near the door. And as soon as he came up, man, I just bang. I'd hand him his drink. And he got such a kick out of that, that he actually, you know, he told his kids that that was really neat. And actually, in the book Marcus Brotherton wrote about Shifty, it's actually, there's a little snippet in there about me doing that for Shifty. So, you know, just once again, it was really cool for me to do that. So we did that for the next subsequent years. And then when Shifty passed away, the following year, the reunion was in Fort Campbell, Kentucky again. And I knew that Earl drank Yingling. They don't sell Yingling in Rhode Island, but I called my contact at Fort Campbell and I said, hey, can you get me a case of Yingling? And he said, yeah, sure. So I says, okay, great. So when I get there, you know. So when Earl when Earl walked in, I gave him a Yingling, just like I would do for Shifty.
Oh, wow.
So that was, yeah, it was just kind of a, you know, it's just kind of a thing, you know, Shifty's not around anymore, buddy, but I want to do this for you. So he got a big kick out of that. And, you know, so like I said, I wasn't Luz, but I was Luz's kid. And so they embraced me for, they embraced me.
Oh, wow. That is so, so fascinating. So is there anything else you want to tell us about, you know, I'm sure you could talk for hours about everything that that you've accumulated over the years by talking to all these guys. Is there anything that stands out that you think would be interesting for people to hear?
Well, you know, there's a couple of things. Let me do this one thing from the Hollywood perspective.
Okay.
One of the writers, his name is John Orloff, and he wrote several different, he directed several episodes, and he worked with the Masters of the Year, and I've met John several times, especially the most recent time. But I want to read just a couple of quick little excerpts. It'll take about a minute. And this is an article that was written in 2018. And it's titled, Why Band of Brothers Lasts, A Perspective from One of Its Writers. So starts off, when Tom Hanks told me and the other screenwriters of Band of Brothers that he was going to place interviews with the guys, as we call them, in front of our episodes, we all howled what a terrible, awful idea it was. It would make everything that followed look like Hollywood reenactments, just as actors in costumes with toy guns. We were so wrong. The interviews gave everything that followed a gravitas, a patina of reality that drove home in a fashion better than any of our writings could do that this was real life. This happened to real men, and many didn't come home. But ultimately, I think Band of Brothers' endurance can be attributed to two things. The inherent power of Easy Company's story in the commitment of every one of the thousand or so people who worked for years to get that story right. But mostly, Band of Brothers succeeded in living up to its ambitious title. Men and now women fight for many reasons, but mostly they fight, kill, and die for their friends in the next foxhole. And that, and it really just kind of typifies, you know, all of the hard work, the story, and then all of the hard work that all of these folks put to get this story told.
Yeah, wow.
And I think that's the article from John. And I appreciate the time to share that.
Yeah, no. That's just amazing to listen to, because it's funny, when you started reading it, I said to myself, well, that's the whole idea of Band of Brothers. The idea that, you know, at the beginning, you don't know who any of these guys are. You know, you have you know, the first, was it 9 episodes where you don't know, actually even the first 10 episodes at the beginning, you just have interviews with some of the guys, but you don't know who's who. And you only find out in the epilogue at the end, you know, which of them there are, which Which, on the one hand, it's good because it doesn't give away who ends up making it and who doesn't, but it also gives you a larger perspective of, the reactions of these men to thinking about what happened to them 55 years earlier. They still all carried this weight of, the camaraderie and the death of their friends and the friendship with people that, again, lasted for decades afterwards. So just to get that the emotion from all of them was always amazing to me. I probably haven't seen the miniseries as many times as you have, but I've probably seen it probably about 15 or 20 times. I mean, it's something that I watch at least once a year, because to me, it's probably my favorite miniseries, because it's so emotional in the way that it builds the characters up and stuff like that. And I mean, that's why for me it's fascinating to talk to you, because it's as close as I can get right now to talking to one of the guys from Easy Company. So to me that's just great. Just one generation off. Or actually, it's not even. It's 1 degree off, because you've met all of them and you've had conversations with them and stuff like that. Now, do you know what made Steven Spielberg and Tom Hanks make the jump from Saving Private Ryan to wanting to create the miniseries of Band of Brothers? Do you have any? I mean, I'm assuming that over the years you've met or you've been in the room with some of them, with both of them, but have they ever explained, what was the catalyst for it? Because, like, for instance, anyone who knows a little bit of film history knows that, Tom Hanks did Apollo 13 with Ron Howard, and then afterwards he decided to do From the Earth to the Moon, which again is another one of my favorite miniseries, From the Earth to the Moon. So it's in some ways it's inevitable that, Tom Hanks would make that jump, from Saving Private Ryan to Band of Brothers, just like he did with Apollo 13 and From the Earth to the Moon. But he hasn't done that for any other movies that he's done over the years. It's those two movies that he was in that he created these two miniseries. And again, obviously the extension of that is both the Pacific and Masters of the Air, which were more companion pieces to stuff from The Greatest Generation. Now, so do you have any idea? I mean, it's possible that you have no idea, but do you have any idea what might have been the catalyst for that?
Well, I would think, I think the way you outlined it, when they bought the rights to both of those books, like I had mentioned earlier, and they read the book, they probably had the aspiration to create something bigger. And, filmmaking is all about timing. And I think their timing was perfect. With the success of Saving Private Ryan, I think they just said, here's a no-brainer.
Right.
And so I'm not quite sure what the timeline was, but
Well,
yeah, I
again, it's
think
not that long
that.
after. The Band of Brothers came out 3 years after Saving Private Ryan, so it's not that far away.
Yeah, because I know what had happened was, I could go back and look at, one of the cool things with Major Winners was when my dad passed away. He made sure that everything he would have sent my dad, he sent to my mom. So we have a steady stream of correspondence from Winners. So Saving Private Ryan comes out. We go to the, my dad and I go, passes away. Not soon after that, it starts the information about Band of Brothers. And, Major Winners made sure my mom got all of those correspondence that he was sending out to the other guys. And what Winners used to do too was he would send in the back of things or in the bottom of a page, if he typed something out in the bottom, he would personalize everything. So what's really cool for me is to see those personalized notes that Winners had sent, not only my dad, but my mom too. And I remember in one of the mailings, he said, "Hey, keep your eye out. There's going to be some big news coming out of Hollywood from Tom Hanks." And then after that news came out, then it was like, who would you like to play George? So it was, you know, it was just all that kind of stuff. So we had that buildup, because you're right. So my dad dies in 98. And then I think it was in 99 at the reunion in Colorado, where HBO was really already engaged. And they did a lot of those interviews that you saw on prior to the episodes. Mm-hmm. A lot of those interviews were done in Denver. And so they were well on their way.
Right. Well, it makes sense. They knew that they were dealing with the time bomb, you know, that they wanted to get these interviews as early as possible. I mean, you could see it with the Pacific. They had very few interviews. And when you got to Masters of the Air, there are no interviews to show, you know, that type of thing. So they knew at the time that if they want to get the interviews, they needed to get them as early as possible, you know, both for clarity purposes and just because, you know, none of these guys were getting younger, you know, at that point.
No, but even in that case there, okay, so 79, let's just say, you know, some of these guys were still in their late 60s, early 70s.
Right.
You know, when the series came out.
Right.
Which in maybe today's standards isn't that old, but,
no.
You know, I know, I'm sorry, nobody could have been in their 60s.
No, they weren't in their 60s. No.
Let's see what my dad.
No, if it was if they started in 42, okay. So let's say the youngest was 18. So that means they were born in 24. You know, which means that the youngest one of them would have been about 75 at the time.
Yeah.
You know, when they might have started doing the interviews, give or take. You know.
Yeah. So, but yeah, so it was really. It was really great to have Winters sharing all of that information. And that's the cool thing is, you know, I've got all of my dad's correspondence with the man and, you know, my sister, my brother and myself, we've got all this really cool stuff. You know what, though? But everybody's got that stuff, too. A lot of people have letters that their loved one sent home. And I always encourage people to, hey, man, jump in those letters, jump in those, read those stories, share those stories, because those things are gold.
Yeah, sounds like it.
And, you know, if it's possible, can I read one last little paragraph?
Yeah, of course.
From Bill here.
Of course.
And this is good because this will kind of typify what it meant, what these guys meant to each other, and if I may.
Of course.
This is about the reunions after the war. When the men get together, nobody talks much about the war. We talk about our families, what we've been doing. If something comes up that has to do with the war, we look at each other. We don't have to say a word. You give a guy a hug or a squeeze, it's understood. You were both there. You both know. If you're a combat veteran, war never leaves you. Every Christmas you spend at Bastogne. Whether you know it or not, you spend it there. It's in your mind, body, and soul. September, you think of Holland. But it's not the same as Bastogne. That was the most haunting part of the war. What happened there remains inside every one of us.
Wow.
And that was in Bill's, Bill and Babe Heffron's book.
Wow. That is so powerful. All right, well, George, thank you. Thank you very much for joining me today and giving me all this, giving me and everyone listening, you know, such fascinating tales about you know, the history of the Menevezy Company and your personal connection to it or anything like that. If anybody is interested in getting in touch with you, how would you suggest they do that?
Well, you can find me on social media. You know, I'm on Facebook, George Lewis Jr. And then actually, I created a website with a friend of mine, Mark from Mark's Game Room. He helped me out with a website, and it's just, if you can remember this, George Luz Jr.com.
Pretty simple.
You can go to my website. Yeah, and like I said, I'm on a board of a foundation. We do documentaries, but those are just a few ways. And then, I'm always trying to stay busy. I volunteer at a ranch in Foster, Rhode Island. It's called the Dare to Dream Ranch. And what we do there is, or what Karen does there, Karen Dalton, is she helps veterans with post-traumatic stress and their families with equine therapy and things like that. So I volunteer on Mondays when I'm in the country. And I am basically a ranch hand. So I just clean up after the animals, if you know what I mean. I'm not any of the technical stuff, but I clean up after the animals. I never knew I had such talent.
Finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Move Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, you can find me on Instagram, you can find me on my website, movearoundminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to movearoundminute@movearound.net. So I will be back tomorrow with another fascinating interview. Once again, thank you very much to George Lewis Jr. for joining us today. And until tomorrow, earn this.
Earn this. Thank you so much, Rob.
In my solitude, you